Well, Devin has actually given a fantastic outline of what we're going to be doing, so I'm pretty much finished, but I'll just chatter with the remaining few minutes. Yeah, we're looking at growing closer to God. Let me explain where that title came from. It actually was given to me as a set title to speak to in 11, something like that, to address the new brothers and sisters we have in Cambodia. And what they'd done, we had our first baptism of someone in Cambodia, of a native, an indigenous Cambodian, in 2007. And as of today, we have 61 members there. So, and 61, all in the same place, all in the capital city, Phnom Penh. And that might be bigger even than your home ecclesia. It is for me. So it is for me, both here in the UK and in the United States. So that's a wonderful growth. It's, what is it, about a one baptism per month. So you can see people are really interested in the gospel, and invariably, they're interested in the gospel when they're poor. So look at any rich country, and you'll see the number of brothers and sisters probably in decline. I don't say that to be depressing, I'm just saying that actually to be encouraging, because if you do see that, and you think it's depressing, fret not. There are many poor countries around the world in which the numbers of brothers and sisters are positively exploding, because just like 2,000 years ago, just like today, people listen to the gospel when they're poor. And riches act merely as a distraction to us. And so therefore I'm very encouraged by every single face I can see right now of people who have not been distracted by whatever riches they have, and they're still interested in the gospel message and interested in hanging out with those with like precious interests. So what are we going to be doing? Devin said, we're going to be looking at growing closer to God, and we're going to be doing that at least vicariously by looking at particular Bible characters. So I'm going to look at Ruth and Jacob particularly. And that's hopefully a good balance, because Jacob not only was a natural Israelite, in fact the entire country was named after him, his name was Israel, and Ruth, by contrast, was a foreigner. So it shows it doesn't matter what nationality you are, it doesn't matter whether you were born to Christadelphian parents and you always grew up in the Sunday school and you kind of know everyone and you're someone who really fits in, because Jacob was, or you could be a bit more like Ruth. You could be a foreigner. Doesn't mean you're not necessarily British either. It just means you could be someone who's like, well, it's kind of someone else's party, and I'm sort of standing on the fringes here, and I'm sort of hoping to be part of it, but I'm not too sure whether I fit in too well. Pretty good to look at Ruth then, because that was absolutely her life story. And so she's the one we're going to be starting with. And of course, Jacob and Ruth contrast well, because one is male and one is female. God is reaching out and wanting both his sons and his daughters to grow closer to him. So we're going to look at those two Bible characters, but that still keeps it in the land of the theoretical. We're also going to look at ourselves very clearly and very explicitly. And on Sunday morning particularly, we're going to look at the subject of prayer, because that's one of the main mechanisms by which we can grow closer to God, so says Jesus. And so I want you to actually think about, between now and Sunday morning, think about your prayers. Think about the types of things you say. Think about the types of things you don't say. Compare them to prayers you've seen in the Bible or prayers you've heard from other people. How can we better learn to pray to connect with God? So that's going to be a fundamental topic we're going to finish with on the Sunday before we have the privilege to break bread and share wine together. So that's what we're doing. These classes, as I say, they've changed a lot for different audiences, but they were originally designed because in Cambodia, the first 7 Bible schools, and I don't know if you've ever done this at Swanwick, but actually have a sequence of 7 years, were planned with a theme, with a flow in mind, to go from one stage of thinking to the next. And we're actually going to come to the 6th of those 7 Bible schools this year, because this is 6 years after 2007. And so this is one of those steps of development that was designed there in a big overarching 7-year pattern. So I'm excited to share those thoughts with you, and I'm excited. I'm the type of speaker who also will be looking for a little bit of feedback here and there, so, stay awake so that in case if I've asked a question, you might be able to pop up and give me your thoughts. So don't feel you have to agree with me either. I want to hear what you think, not what you think I want to hear. That's more valuable to all of us in growing together. So that's what we're hoping to do, and I think it's going to be a very exciting weekend. So then, growing closer to God. Now, how interesting it is. The last words out of your mouth. What were the last words out of your mouth? I love you, Lord. Did you ever stop to think, what does God think, what does the Lord think when you say that? The reason why I ask that question, because quite possibly we think, oh, I've shown love to the Lord. There we go. I'm in a good place. All is well. I don't want to unsettle you. But here's something to think about. Who's that, by the way? Catherine Zeta-Jones is someone older than me. Yes, quite so. Yes, maybe not on the front pages right now, but a relatively famous movie actress of British origin, in fact, now living in the United States. And I was reading an interview that she gave about 15 years ago, and the bulk of the interview and what she had to say was relatively unsurprising, but there was one particular comment that was poignant and that was meaningful and that I thought had great value for myself in my discipleship, because she has a great fan base. She's a very beautiful woman, and so she received lots of communications, and in pre-email days, there was lots of letters, and of course there'd be a lot of love letters from men primarily, but not solely, and saying that they were in love with her and they wanted to marry her. And her reply, perhaps again unsurprising, was this. She said, "They keep saying that they love me and want to marry me, but how can they love me when they don't even know who I am?" And I thought, that's interesting, that even a human could figure that out, that if someone doesn't know you, any expression of love they have to you, at some level, is relatively empty. They've seen her, they like what they see, but they have no idea who she is. And therefore, she says, "I essentially don't wish to reject you as a human being, but I deny your statement of love towards me because you've got no idea who I am." So we sing, and we feel good to sing, "I love you, Lord." And what does the Lord say? Does he say, "Yes, John, I know you do"? Or does he say to me, "John, you really haven't put in a great deal of effort to understanding who I am, so thank you for your kind sentiment, but really, your statement is a little more meaningful than that you might write to a movie star. You don't know who I am." So there is perhaps something to think about as our responsibility. If we want to grow closer to God, if we want to take ownership of those words, "I love you, Lord," then at some level, we've got to be clear who that Lord is. And that's why we're going to turn our attentions to the biblical character of Ruth. Because Ruth, in a way, is a figure of all of us. She was an alien to the family of God. She was from outside. She had been grown up, quite possibly speaking a different language, and certainly either not worshipping a God or worshipping a God that didn't even exist. And so she had to start from scratch to learn, and I want us to appreciate and enjoy how fast she learned and how well she learned. And this wasn't an academic learning. This was a sensitive learning of learning to see the hand of God in her life, and more importantly, learning to realize how God worked, and therefore we'll see how she utilized that in her own spiritual growth to grow closer to God. So for that reason, let's take a reading. If you have a Bible with you, I hope you do. But if you don't, by the way, I'm going to put all relevant verses on the screen, so I'm not going to have an open Bible in front of me, but don't think we're not looking at Bible verses, because they're all going to be on the screen. And we're going to consider this character who might have felt very distanced from this new religion, from this new God that she'd heard about from Naomi. It wasn't a culture that she would in any way be able to recognize. And I wonder of how many of you might feel the same way. Do you sometimes look at our Christian denomination culture and say, "This is not a culture I realize"? Does anyone feel just maybe a little bit alienated every now and again from that culture? A little show of hands. Yeah, there's just a couple. And put your hand up. If you're embarrassed to put your hand up, show me now. Yeah? Yeah, that's hardly fair. Oh, good. There's always always good to identify the jokers early and keep an eye on them, right? That's a speaker's trick. We're going to take a reading, though. Ruth chapter 2. We're going to start at the beginning, and we're going to read all of Ruth 2 and the first 11 verses as well of Ruth chapter 3. And rather than just letting the words roll over you, what I want you to do is see the discussion about wings and coverings and see the sensitivity and see how both Boaz and Ruth are doing something really rather intricate, which we'll explore in detail. So I asked Brother Sam Ridgway, if he's hiding out there, to come. And there he is. Great. to come and do that reading for us, please. Thank you.
Reading together from the book of Ruth, starting at chapter 2. And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, Let me now go into the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said unto her, Go, my daughter. And she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to light on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz, who was of the kindred of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and said unto the reapers, The Lord be with you. And they answered him, The Lord bless thee. Then said Boaz unto his servant that was set over the reapers, Whose damsel is this? And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, It is the Moabitish damsel that came back from with Naomi out of the country of Moab. And she said, I pray you, let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came, and hath continued even from the morning unto now, that she tarrieth a little in the house. Then said Boaz unto Ruth, Hearest thou not, my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens. Let thine eyes be on the field, and they do reap, and go thou after them. Have I not charged the young men, that they shall not touch thee? And when thou art athirst, go unto the vessels, and drink of that which the young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face, and bowed herself to the ground, and said unto him, Why have I found faith, why have I found grace in thine eyes, that thou shouldest take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger? And Boaz answered, and said unto her, It hath fully been shown me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thine husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother and the land of thy nativity, and hast come to unto a place which thou knewest not hitherto. The Lord recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to trust. Then she said, Let me find favour in thy sight, my Lord, for that thou hast comforted me, and for that thou hast spoken friendly unto thine handmaid, though I be not like unto one of thine handmaids. Then Boaz said unto her, At mealtime come thou hither, and eat of the bread, and dip thy morsel in the vinegar. And she sat beside the reapers, and he reached her parched corn, and she did eat, and was sufficed, and left. And when she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, Let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not, and let fall some of the handfuls on purpose for her, and leave them, that she may glean them, and rebuke her not. So she gleaned in the field until even, and beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up, and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought forth and gave to her that she had reserved after she was sufficed. And her mother-in-law said unto her, Where hast thou gleaned today, and where waterest thou? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of thee. And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought, and said, The man's name was with whom I wrought today is Boaz. And Naomi said unto her daughter-in-law, Blessed be he of the Lord, who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead. And Naomi said unto her, The man is a near kin of us, one of our next kinsmen. And Ruth the Moabitess said, He said unto me also, Thou shalt keep fast by my young men until they have ended all my harvest. And Naomi said unto Ruth her daughter-in-law, It is good, my daughter, that thou go out with his maidens, that thou meet with thee in any other field. So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of the barley harvest and of the wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee? And now is not Boaz of our kindred, with whose maidens thou wast? Behold, he winnoweth barley tonight in the threshing floor. Wash thyself, therefore, and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor. But make not thyself known unto the man, until he should have done eating and drinking. And it shall be, when he lieth down, Thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in, and uncover his feet, and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do. And she said unto her, All that thou sayest unto me I will do. And she went down unto the floor, and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn. And she came softly, and uncovered his feet, and laid her down. And it came to pass at midnight, that the man was afraid, and turned himself. And behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, Who art thou? And she answered, I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman. And he said, Blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter, for thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, fear not, I will do to thee all that thou requirest, for all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman.
Thank you very much, Sam. I appreciate that. So there's some of the verses we've just read, so I won't read through them all again. But she performs this strange action of uncovering his feet, lying down at his uncovered feet, and waiting there for something else to occur. So the question is simple. What is she doing? Well, for starters, we know she's not acting randomly, because this is something that's been planned out by both her and her mother-in-law. So she's clearly got something in mind. And I think what's going on is she's responding to something that Boaz has said a few months earlier at the earlier harvest. And she's doing it in a very clever but equally romantic way. And I want to see us to explore exactly this dynamic of what's going on between them, because it turns out both of them are very sensitive to the method in which their father works. And that's how they're showing that they're growing closer to God, and they're actually behaving in the same way that God does. So first of all, and I don't want this to be a language lesson, firstly because I'm not really qualified, but there's perhaps at least just one word we should pay attention to. I am your servant Ruth, she said. This quote is from the NIV. Spread the corner of your garments. Four whole English words there, but it's only one Hebrew word. And there it is printed out for you, Konoff. And perhaps it's useful to point out it's the origin of our word canopy. So you can probably see the root of the word canopy lurking in there. And so the wing or the canopy of the garment is what she's talking about. And that word in Hebrew, meaning canopy, also has one other use, and quite literally it's the wing of a bird. So in Hebrew, if you're speaking Hebrew, the bird has two canopies, which makes sense. They spread out, they cover over and whatnot. So, and that's going to be very relevant. So if you look in other versions, I am Ruth, this is the old King James, I am Ruth thine handmaid, spread therefore thy skirt. That's that Hebrew word canopy. That's how I'm going to pronounce it. That's the canopy word there. And if you look at the New King James, and the New King James has done something, you might think it's taken a few artistic liberties here, but it hasn't. When it says, take me under your wing, that's actually an excellent translation, because it really is, this word canopy really is the word that the Hebrews use for the wings of a bird. So she's saying to Boaz, take me under your wing. And before she's done that, she's peeled back his wing, as it were, so that not only is she uncovered socially, not physically, but socially, because she's a widow with no one to take care of her, but also he is partially uncovered. And I think there's a reason for that, and there are two reasons. First of all, because the idea of covering with the garment, with the wing of the garment, was a known engagement custom. So that's something we should know about, and Naomi would have known about. Spread the wing of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but that's something that God says to his chosen bride being Israel, and he says this, When I looked at you, says God, and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the wing over you, the corner of my garment, the canopy over you, and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. I dressed you in fine linens, covered you with costly garments, and adorned you with jewelry. So that's the engagement custom. So Ruth is harking back to this biblical, if you will, even though Ezekiel comes a lot later. It's a known custom within God's people to do that. But I think more relevantly also, there's actually a nice little word game going on, which we lose in English, but I'd like to share with you again just the Hebrew words, because there's a little word game going on. Ruth approaches him and uncovers him, and then says, cover me with your wing, since you are a, and here's a real clunky phrase, kinsman redeemer. Yeah, well, I use that word three times a day, I'm sure, right? That's a very sort of clumsy sort of phrase. But in Hebrew, that's simply, since you are a coverer. I have uncovered you. Now, what will you do for me? And in fact, both of us who are uncovered, because you are a coverer. That is what you do. So the words themselves, the Hebrew word used here for uncovered is galah, and it's kind of a little symmetrically, ga'al is to cover over or redeem. So I have galah so that you, because you are ga'al. What I have done is the opposite of what you are. So if you do what you do, then we shall be covered. And it's similar, you know, it's quite a very simplistic little game, similar to the little child's game of peekaboo, right? That she has said, I have galah because you are ga'al. So that's perhaps a role that I invite you to, if you would like to take that role. And perhaps on the emotional level, and this is perhaps almost the most important level, it's the idea that she, why did she uncover him first, or partly? I think she's trying to provoke a sense of empathy. You don't probably like sleeping through the night with your feet uncovered. You get cold and you feel there's a need for a covering. Well, look what's lying at your feet. That would be me. I am uncovered. I have no coverer. And you are Ga'al. You are the coverer. So I have Galah so that you can Ga'al, because you will desire to cover your own feet. Will you desire also to cover that which lies at your feet? Is there an empathy here? Is there a feeling in you that can think that when I am uncovered, says Ruth, why even part of you feels uncovered? Because we know that's how God feels. It's common for us. We believe that God cannot be destroyed and cannot die. And I'm not going to attempt to change your thoughts there, because I think that's absolutely right. But because we believe God cannot be destroyed, we tend to believe that he cannot feel pain and he cannot feel a sense of vulnerability. And he can. The Bible tells us in Genesis 6 that when he saw so much sin in the earth, his heart was filled with pain. So God cannot die. God cannot be damaged. But he can and does feel pain. And so he feels an empathy with his people. God heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. And God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Even though he has no vulnerabilities in himself, he has that wonderful empathy that says, well, if you are uncovered, it's almost like I feel uncovered and exposed. And I have a desire to do something about that. And you and I shouldn't just sit there going, oh, that's nice for them to do that. We are invited to feel the same way. We know that the whole creation groans as in childbirth right to the present time. And therefore, we who claim to have the first fruits of the Spirit should groan inwardly as we also await for a time of change. So we should actually feel the pain of mortality. And I don't mean the physical limitation of getting older. I mean the actual pain, the fact that there are things, there are desires inside us that are destructive. And we desire to be proud. We desire to be damaging. We occasionally desire to hurt other people with our words or with our actions. And that's something that we should feel a pain because of, and a desire to be rid of, a desire to be rid of that time. So what was it then that Boaz had done that triggered this understanding in Ruth? Boaz had said this back in chapter 2, and that's why we took the reading, which was rather long. He says, I've been told about everything you've done. You've been a very honorable woman. You've actually stuck by your mother-in-law when your mother-in-law had nothing to offer you. She had no food or income of her own to take care of you, and yet you stuck by her. And Boaz says, I understand why you did that. May you be blessed and rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you came to take refuge. Okay. And obviously, I'm guessing you already know now, this word wings here is exactly the same as the bit of the robe that Ruth touched, the canopy, the wing. So Boaz has said, I know why you came here. You came here to take refuge under the canopies of the God of Israel. And I think that's played a big role in what Ruth and Naomi planned to do, to call Boaz on his faith and say, so you have this belief that your God is a, a sheltering God, a covering God. Are you really going to act on that belief? And I wonder then, so Ruth is responding to this comment of Boaz months earlier, what wings do you suppose, I mean, it's just a metaphor, and yet Boaz has probably been prompted to use this metaphor because of something that he knows about. What wings of the God of Israel, so to speak, do you think that Boaz is referencing? What wings may he even have physically seen? What wings cover over? What's your familiarity with the Old Testament that might help you answer that question? Anyone? Very good. I think, yeah, these wings, because they're all to do with mercy. The top cover of the ark was called the mercy seat. And even though God is everywhere, we seem to meet God in such a way that there are places, even occasionally geographical places, where his presence is more focused, more densely focused. And God has introduced himself to his people by saying, if you want to know where is the center place of my mercy, it is right here, oops, I'm a bit wobbly, underneath these covering wings. Underneath the wings is where I center my mercy. And I think Boaz knew that. And because he knew his God, he was familiar with his God, he was able to say, I understand how my God works. He spreads his wings to cover people. That is his definition of mercy. You will make two cherubim of gold, God instructed, at the two ends of the mercy seat. The cherubim will stretch out their wings above and cover the mercy seat with their wings. And so when Boaz wakes up and finds what Ruth has done, and Ruth explains, well, I did galah so that you would ga'al with your wings over me, responding to when Boaz had said, you came here to shelter under the wings of the God of Israel. Here's something, and it matters which translation of the Bible you have, so you have to be a little bit careful in seeking this out, but this is very important. The Lord bless you, says Boaz, this kindness is greater than the one you showed earlier, because Boaz is a lot older than her, and he says, I noticed that you didn't necessarily feel that you just had to go after the men of your own generation. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. That was the first kindness that Ruth did to Boaz. But Boaz then says, well, wait, this second kindness is better. So what is this second kindness? If the first one was not necessarily just looking at the men of our own generation, what was the second kindness? Let me paraphrase to explain what I think Boaz has seen in what Ruth is doing. Boaz has said to Ruth at the barley harvest, you have come to take refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. And in this little enacted romantic scene in the middle of the night, Ruth has essentially said to Boaz, can I, or implying I can actually find refuge under your wings. Why is that important? Because Boaz has said, you've come to look for refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. And Ruth said, yes, that's right. That would be under your wings. In other words, Ruth is saying, in you, I see the reflection of the God of Israel. In short, you are clearly a godly man, a man who not only knows his God, but speaks about his God and behaves like God does. That's what that enacted parable comes to say. How very subtle, but how very powerful. And Boaz sees that and he says, thank you so much. That's even better than the kindness you did me before. So there's actually, these are two very intelligent and spiritually knowledgeable people playing back and forth in this romantic interplay when Ruth is saying, I'm able to see the God of Israel in you. That is the second kindness, the greater kindness, and Boaz rightly thanks her for it. And this is perhaps one of the most important parts about the kindness or the spirituality of God. It results in real action. That was a lovely interplay. They exchanged some lovely words and a nice little parable. Boaz then married Ruth and took care of her. He followed through on what he proclaimed to understand. And that's where, if you like the old phrase, what's where the rubber hits the road. That's where mirroring God involves action. So if we speak about a God of shelter, a God of comfort, a God of provision, and if we sing, I love you, Lord, if you love a God who shelters, a God who comforts, a God who provides, then that love is empty unless that's exactly what we do. And for Boaz, it wasn't just empty words. He saw a widow who was in need of comfort, of shelter, of redemption. And he acted, and he took her, and he married her, so that Mahlon would again have life, and so that Ruth and her family would be taken care of. And time passes, and Ruth and Boaz, they have a son, and the son has a son, and the son has a son. And who is that great-grandson of Ruth? David, King David. Yeah? Jesse, the father of King David. So here's something I want to introduce to you, whether you've noticed it before. I want to suggest to you that very pretty pattern involving the wings and the exchange between Boaz and Ruth, a very well-known love story, actually plays a big role in David's language in the Psalms. David, I suggest to you, learned this story, probably by oral tradition, on the knee of his mother or his grandmother. He may not have been alive or at the time that Ruth was alive, but it's quite clear that this idea of sheltering wings is something that means an awful lot to David, because he writes things like this: "Keep me as the apple of your eye," to his father. "Hide me in the shadow of your canopies," of your wings. It's that same Hebrew word. "How priceless is your unfailing love," writes David. "Both high and low among men, find refuge in the shadow of your wings." That's a direct quote from Boaz, his great-grandfather. You can tell this story meant a lot to David. "I long to dwell in your tent forever and take refuge in the shelter of your wings." Notice this. There is no other writer in the Old Testament who ever uses this metaphor. It's only David. It's only the great-grandson of the two who enacted this beautiful parable. This is a unique trait and a unique metaphor of his, and I am utterly convinced, although I can't prove it to you, that it's because of what his great-grandmother had done. David loves this metaphor, a metaphor that stems so clearly from his personal family. He uses it in 7 psalms. I've overspoken there, because in actual fact there are 7 psalms that use it, and 6 of the psalms say this is a psalm of David. And the 7th psalm, which is Psalm 91, I think, do you know what that one says? It says, "We don't know who wrote this psalm." And I think to myself, well, I'd like to say I do, because there's only one man who uses this metaphor, and it's always David. "These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children." Ruth took that at face value, even though she was a stranger to the Mosaic law. Look how she affected the man after God's own heart. The man after God's own heart only partly became the man after God's own heart because of the character and actions of his great-grandmother, Ruth. So think about this. You will affect people after you are dead. If you are godly enough, or I suppose godless enough, whatever, if you do big things in your life, don't just look for the effects they have in the moment. After you die, you will have a legacy of effect on those new children growing up to learn about God. It's a fascinating thing to think. And I think if we see the depth of how this metaphor is close to David's heart, it helps us understand a verse in David's life story, which otherwise is really very puzzling. There's a time when Saul is pursuing him. That happens more than once. And Saul is chasing him through the desert to kill him. And David's ended up in the back of a cave. And as chance would have it, Saul comes and takes a rest, probably goes to sleep in the front of the cave, and David has a chance to kill Saul. He doesn't want to kill Saul. He's a man after God's own heart, and he realizes he'll have the throne when the time is good and right. But what he does do is he wants to show Saul he's been near enough to kill him and spared him, so he just slices off a piece of his robe. Now, as he's running through the caves, interestingly, he again uses this metaphor. Psalm 57 was written at this time. He's fleeing from Saul when he says, "Have mercy on me, O God." Probably thinking about the top of the ark. Under those wings. "Have mercy on me, for in you my soul takes refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until Saul's murderous campaign has passed." That's what he writes at that exact time. And then we get this very strange verse in the middle of 1 Samuel. David crept up unnoticed and cut off the wing, the canopy, of Saul's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken. Or older versions have cut to the heart for having cut off the wing of the robe. Why? It's only a piece of clothing. Yes, it's the king's clothes. Yes, it's not yours. It's not generally right to wreck other people's clothing, but he was doing it to show he'd spared his life. Why? Because he realizes he's cut off the very piece of the robe which is used as the metaphor for mercy. David amputated Saul's wing, the symbol of Saul's ability to reflect God in showing mercy. This is what cuts David to the heart, I have no doubt about it. That's why we're told about it. That's why it's useful to know. He realizes he's accidentally marred that beautiful legacy that his great-grandmother had given him. The very bit of Boaz's robe that would have been thrown over her as a sign of mercy, he took that away from the king of Israel and the Lord's anointed. What's the method? What's the message? Don't obstruct others' efforts to be merciful. We see that played out, albeit in parable form, back there in 1 Samuel. I think that's a beautiful thing. Now, I said David was the only Old Testament writer who ever employed the metaphor of sheltering under the wings, but there was one man, even more godly than he, who also uses exactly the same language. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, says Jesus of Nazareth, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often have I longed to gather your children together, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. It's not in Hebrew now, so it's not the same Hebrew word, obviously, but clearly it's the same metaphor. But you were not willing. Jesus himself knew this is the behavior of the Father. It is to look on those chicks who have no protection and ensure they can be covered by the wings of the parent bird. Maybe there's one more interesting detail we can pick up en route and explain, a verse which to me never made sense to do with the crucifixion. What happened to Jesus' clothes during the crucifixion? Do you remember? There, the soldiers gambled for them. Well, they divided up, they shared out some of them, and then the robe, which was all sewn up in one piece, they said, well, it seemed normally they'd rip it up. And they said, well, it's all set in one piece, so let's not do that. Let's gamble for it instead. The garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. Let's not tear it, they said, the soldiers. Let's decide by lot who will get it. So the wings of Jesus' robe were never amputated. They were never cut off. So within the metaphor in which we're operating, we're saying the ability of Jesus to save was never taken away, even in death. And in fact, as we know from our Christian hope, in fact, the death of Jesus was a marvelous spreading of wings that allowed anyone who wanted to, anyone who saw what was going on, to understand, yeah, these wings are spreading now. His death doesn't amputate those wings. His death is the spreading of those wings. And maybe just in form there, you have that little detail that God shares with anyone who's listening closely. Yeah, they didn't cut the wings off his robe, notice. And I think that's useful to know. And I share that with you quite happily for that reason. And finally, of course, who are they pointing at? They're pointing at the Father. And God has been behaving this way the whole time. This is a very important verse in Deuteronomy. As an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, we have this interesting and maybe slightly derogatory phrase called helicopter parents. You know what I mean? The ones who flutter around and almost take too much attention over their children. But God is like that. God says, I'm one of those. I'm a helicopter parent. As an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings, so the Lord alone leads Israel. That verb describes God's emotion. He's hovering over. He's trembling with excitement to see his children grow and develop, hoping that they will call out to him with meaningful expressions of their love for him. And where have we seen this word before? Anyone know? It's a really difficult question, so it's kind of unfair. Oh, easy for some, evidently. The second verse of the Bible. God made the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. You get the sense that he'd given birth to this thing which, as yet unformed, could grow into something so fabulous for his glory. And he's just hovering over the top, trembling with excitement, just as a father might do in an emergency room if he hasn't passed out, watching the birth of his child. You get that same sense, that picture that God has at all times been spreading his wings and hovering over his young to see how they will grow and develop. And David, Ruth, Jesus have been very sensitive to this picture, and I hope we can be sensitive to it too. Not just so that we can write beautiful poetry involving a metaphor of spreading wings, not for that reason. So then for what reason? And this will be the end of this little talk, and we'll take a break and start into a break so you can relax and rejuvenate. Here's the reason. So this will probably be the last slide of this little talk. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. Those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. What's that? Beautiful words, right? Encouraging. When's that going to happen? Oh, in the kingdom. Really? In the kingdom. It will happen for sure, and in a fullness it cannot happen now. But I think God is calling us to do that now. And now that we understand the metaphors that we've seen, we should be able to translate these words as something new. Watch this. The metaphor, if we're to be seen as an eagle, we ascend to heaven, right? There's a way in which I don't mean it, so don't panic. We ascend to heaven, i.e. learn to fly, by spreading our wings, right? That's just what the metaphor says. So if we translate each of those three lines, we've seen from the life of Ruth what that means. To ascend to heaven, obviously, is to grow closer to God. We learn to fly by spreading his wings, by copying his character. And what is the character of one who spreads his wings? It's the provision of mercy. The actual provision of taking care of the poor. When we start doing that, the more times we take care of the poor, the more our wings go from being clapped to our sides to starting to go outwards. Until eventually, when it becomes part of our life to do that, then our wings are spread. And if our wings are spread, we can fly. And if we can fly, we can ascend to heaven. And if we can ascend to heaven, we can grow closer to God. Now, you might think that's an awful lot to put on one metaphor. And that's why we're going to have the second half of this session to justify exactly what we mean of how important it is in this current time to give to the poor. So we're on the theme of growing closer to God, and specifically we've learned from the example of Ruth and Boaz and David and Jesus how spreading the wings is an absolutely vital part of learning to be like God. Now, the April before last, or so April 2012, I had the privilege to be in Hawaii briefly. I had lots of things to do, but at one point at least I had 3 or 4 hours to myself, so needless to say, I just went and crashed out on a beach and just lay there in the sun. And 3.2 minutes later I was bored. I'm like, oh, okay, can't really do that. Need something for my mind to do. What am I going to do? And I thought, well, coming up in about 8 months, I have to give some classes on growing closer to God. So I should get to work, get my mind to work at least, even though while I'm enjoying my surroundings, and do something useful. So I prayed and said, you know, I'd like to use this time usefully, Father, so if you can assist me with anything in just learning or gaining something useful about growing closer to God, I'll try and be sensitive to it, I'll try and be observant to it. And no sooner had I finished praying, and that's not unusual, I've found this happens a number of times, seconds after I'd finished praying, I sort of sat up on the beach and I looked around, and maybe all I needed to be was observant, and what I saw was pretty much what you're looking at right now. So I took a photo. And what you're looking at right now is a man and a boy in the water, and their dynamic and their relationship between them made it pretty clear that that was a father and his son. And here's what was going on, is the father was teaching the son how to swim. When I say teaching, in actual fact, the son could swim pretty well already. So the deal was this, the father would say to the boy, here, you go off and he'd swim out, ooh, and about twice the distance away that the screen shows, and then I'll call out a type of swimming stroke, and you swim to me with that stroke, so breaststroke or front crawl or whatever. And the boy would do it, and actually he was pretty good. He was still learning, but he was a pretty good swimmer, and he was having a good time, and the dad was having a good time too. And then there was one stroke which the boy had trouble with. Not physically so much, but there was one stroke where clearly he was not so happy, and the father had to call out a lot more encouragement and a lot more reassurance for him to be able to complete the task of swimming to his father. Do you have any idea what stroke was that and why? Butterfly is definitely the technically most difficult. But actually it wasn't the butterfly, believe it or not. Even though it was the backstroke. Why? It couldn't see his dad. And it was crazy because I could actually see him. The boy was only 8 or 9, I'm guessing. The father was calling out all the things you'd expect. It's like, well, of course I'm still here. You know, I've been here all morning. I mean, I'm not nipped off anyway. Because every time he was doing a backstroke, he decided, oh, I'll just turn and look at my dad, check he's still there. And of course he'd go under. because you can't do that and backstroke at the same time. Either you do backstroke or you turn around and stand up and look at your dad. And he clearly wanted to do both. And so what I learned was it was a lot harder for the son when he couldn't physically see his father. So I have some empathy with, we can all have empathy with each other. Discipleship is the backstroke, right? You cannot physically see your father. But just as that boy became a little bit more nervous and a little bit more worried, the son felt close to the father when the father was visible. But the father was still there, even when he wasn't visible. And perhaps that's the encouragement I took in discipleship, is realistically, we know that the father is still there. We've seen his hand working in our lives, no matter how short or long our lives may have been to this point. We know he's there. And yes, this is backstroke, so it's a little hard when you can't see him physically. But trust that he's there. And that was a wonderful little lesson to just see enacted right in front of me. And the other thing I noticed that I observed was that the father was having just as great a time as the son was. But the father felt close to the son because they were working together on the father's program, which was swimming. Right? So had the son decided to say, oh, I don't want to swim. I'm going to get out of the sea and wander out of the sea up the beach. So I want to build some sandcastles. Start building sandcastles. Would the father have stopped loving the son? No. Would the father have got angry with the son? Probably not. But that sense of closeness would have been lost. Because a lot of our time, you know, the Bible teaches us how to swim, and we're like, yeah, I want to make sandcastles. And so think what effect that has on the father. Does it anger him? I doubt it. Does he stop loving you? Certainly not. But it probably saddens him a bit that, like, well, I've got this great swimming program for you, and it'll be ever so much fun. And we're all busy chomping up the beach saying, I want to make sandcastles. Right? And I look back on my life and see a lot of half-made sandcastles. And ironically, even in the physical world, I don't swim too well. So that's what I noticed. The son needs to follow the instruction in order to preserve the closeness of the relationship, in order for dad to have just as much fun as the son was having. And in this case, it was working really well, and they were having a great time. So that was one thing I noticed right away. So I was grateful to God for giving me such a valuable little gem right there when I was able to see it. So then, what does God want us to do? What is his swimming program, as it were? What should we be doing to grow close to God? And this is a question we don't have to make up, because that's happened in time past. People have come out to a man called John the Baptist and said, so then, what are we supposed to do? And John says, metaphorically, produce fruit in keeping with repentance. Yes, is the crowd, what does that mean? And what did John say? Silence. Not quite right. He said things. You're still with me. I can see the eyes. What did John say? Can anyone remember what his answer was? Repent and be baptized is an excellent answer. That's an answer Peter gave later. Yeah, I like that answer. It's not what John said at the time. I'm sorry? Bring forth fruits for repentance. Yeah, you read that off the screen. That's the bit. We got that bit. And then the crowd says, what does that mean in real terms? And John says, I'll tell you what it means in real terms. It means the light of the world. No, that's the other gospel. Oh, very good. He said six things, one of which, well done, Phil, was soldiers do not abuse your authority. Be content that someone's remembered number six. Good job. Be content with your wages. This is what he said. And it's funny the bits we remembered, and it's funny the bits we didn't remember, particularly when I said at the end of the last talk, it's all going to be about giving to the poor, which was a bit of a clue. Because I'm nice like that with my clues. But I didn't always get through. John said this, anyone who has two shirts, give to the one who has none. Anyone the same with food, do the same. Don't, he said to the tax collectors, collect more than you have to. Do not extort money. Don't accuse people falsely. And be content with your pay. Those last two going to the soldiers. Okay, so those are the six things that John the Baptist said. Memory test, let's do them again. Six things. Number one, share your shirts. No, I like this one. You can have another one. So share your shirts. Let me paraphrase. Take care of the poor. Number two was what? Do the same thing with food. Which is interesting because John says, number one, take care of the poor. And number two, just in case you weren't listening to number one, take care of the poor. What was number three? I can't remember myself, so I'm just going to leave that question sat on you. It was don't extort money. That's right. So don't create more poor, right? And don't collect more taxes than you have to. So number four, just in case you weren't listening to number three, don't create more poor. So this is a fairly simple list so far, isn't it? And then the last two, don't abuse your authority and be content with your wages, or if you like, don't be greedy. So those are the six things that John says. And in actual fact, number five and six also are somewhat to do with the poor, aren't they? Because the people who are in power are never poor, and the people who are out of power are quite often poor. So it is the rich over the poor there. And of course, number six has to do with the poor as well, because if we take more of the world's resources than we need, then we're essentially creating more poor for people who can't have what they might need. So if I had to summarize all of those six things, what would you might say as a summary of all of that? Love your neighbor. Or in fact, since that's quite specific, love your neighbor in the sense of take care of the poor. I'm not saying this is the entirety of the gospel message, there's nothing else involved at all. I'm not saying that. But this is the center of the gospel message that John the Baptist communicated at that time. And I guess, and I share this with you partly from my own experience, simply because I grew up in this community and I somehow spaced on it. And when people, it's interesting, whenever I ask, what did John the Baptist say? Be content with your wages is sometimes remembered, and Phil remembered the one about abusing the authority. And it's very seldom in our community do we ever remember that John the Baptist said, take care of the poor, even though he took the trouble to say it four different ways so that we wouldn't miss it. In fact, the language about how important it is to take care of the poor in the Bible is a lot stronger than I ever thought it was until I dug it out. Let me show you how strong it is. How do you get treasure in heaven? If someone were to ask you, how do you get treasure in heaven, what might you say? You would say nothing. Excellent. That's very reserved. Yeah? I'll tell you what I would have said. I would say something like, well, treasure is where your heart is. Therefore, if you care about and love the things that are in heaven, the Lord Jesus, for example, and the things that he stands for, that's how you show you have treasure in heaven. I like that answer. Sounds good. Sounds clever. But that's not what Jesus said. When Jesus said this is how you get treasure in heaven, what did he say? Give to the poor. Now, you're either guessing on the momentum of the talk we've had so far, which is very intelligent, or you knew. either way, I like it. That's right. Jesus said, teacher, what good thing must I do to get eternal life? He was asked. And he says, there's only one who's good. If you want to enter life, obey the commandments. I've kept the commandments, said the young man. What do I still lack? Well, if you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. So that's how you get treasure in heaven. You give to the poor. The more that you give away here to the poor on earth, then it's a different type of treasure that you're gaining in heaven. That wasn't the answer that I thought of. But in fairness, that is what Jesus said. And when you've got the choice between what I say and what Jesus says, probably best to go with his. And so we gain treasure in heaven by giving to the poor. What do I still lack? I think that's why Jesus loved him. It said Jesus loved him. This is a man who, unlike me, has kept all the commandments. And he was smart enough to know, spiritually smart enough to know, I've kept all the commandments, and I know I'm missing something. And Jesus said, go spread your wings. That's what you need to do. How do you become clean on the inside? I guess the answer's kind of obvious by now. But that's not language that I would have associated with giving to the poor. Someone asked me, hey, spiritually speaking, John, what do you reckon? How do you become clean on the inside? I said, well, what are clean things? Clean things are good things, righteous things. If you think about these, if you absorb these, if you meditate on these good things, you'll become clean on the inside. I still like that answer. It's not what Jesus said. Jesus said this. He'd gone to dinner with a Pharisee, and the Pharisee was most perturbed that he hadn't washed his hands first. So Jesus says, now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish. Inside, you're full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside too? Give what is inside the dish to the poor, and everything will become clean. So that's how you become clean on the inside, you give to the poor. Really? That is not an intuitive answer. That is not a deductive answer. And I could have sat down with a Hebrew lexicon for a day and a half, and I would never have got there. But it's what Jesus said, and I need to listen to it. We become clean on the inside by giving to the poor. We can turn it around and look at the negative side of the same coin. What happens if you don't give to the poor. This is just the same argument approached from the other side. Interestingly, Sodom was identified as having five sins. What were they? They didn't care for the poor. Rachel's picked up the easy points there for Rachel in the third row. Good job. Idleness, that's pretty good. Yeah, they were overfed and unconcerned. You're doing well here. Let's look at that list. This was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant. And part of the reason I'm showing this to you is because Sodom is something that I've always been able to keep at arm's length. I'm not of Sodom. You know, what is Sodom known for? Well, unfortunately, it's become a word, hasn't it? Sodomite and sodomy has become a word in the English language. And it's for a particular deviant sexual practice. I'm like, oh, I can easily shove that at arm's length. I don't do that. And besides, they were attacking people in the streets and trying to rape them. I don't do that. You know, I might not be doing too well, but at least I am not actually as an inhabitant of Sodom. And then God says, well, listen up, Popol, I've got some news for you. You ever been called arrogant? Oh, whoops, yes. You ever been called arrogant accurately? Yes. Sodomites were arrogant. They were overfed and unconcerned. Fat and happy. Couldn't be bothered about anyone else. I will suck my stomach in at this point, but it will probably creep out again later. I hope you don't notice. They didn't take care of the poor. That's number 3 out of 5. Number 4, they were haughty, which sounds very similar to number 1, doesn't it? And I'm like, goodness me, by the time we got here, I'm 80% a citizen of Sodom already. So even if, you know, regardless of what the last one means, which may have been those sexual activities, it may be something else. It's not even specific. I myself am equally 80% as guilty as those in Sodom. Therefore, says God, I did away with them. And therefore, says God, I will do away with you too, John, if that is the life you're going to continue to lead. So, God destroyed Sodom partly because they didn't help the poor. And finally, there was a case in Ezekiel where God said, I will refuse to hear your prayers. Over what? It was over setting fire to your children in sacrifice. And you might say, oh, well, that's good. Thank goodness I really haven't done that. You know, I really haven't set fire to my children, maybe a sibling or two, but, you know, I'm sure that's all right. But, you know, no one has sacrificed in this society. It's just completely unthought of. Those are the verses. Will you defile yourselves the way your fathers did? They sacrificed their sons in the fire. And if you do that, will I let you inquire of me? Will I hear your prayers? I will not let you inquire of me, because you sacrifice your sons and daughters in the fire. Oh, also, if you don't give to the poor, same thing. If a man shuts his ears to the cry of the poor, he too will cry out and not be answered. That's pretty striking, isn't it? The punishment for setting fire to your children is the same as the punishment for not giving to the poor, which suggests, I cannot prove it, but it suggests that God sees those two offenses in a roughly similar light. That's a bit striking, isn't it? Considering how abhorrent crimes against children are to our society. God says, yeah, same for not giving to the poor. God won't hear the prayers of those who sacrifice their children or won't give to the poor. Wow. So it's not that giving to the poor is some new idea, but I had not myself realized just the strength of language in the Bible that is attributed to this particular thing. So the importance of giving to the poor. The negative side, if we don't, our prayers won't be heard. If we don't, well, Sodom was destroyed, partly because they didn't. It's the way we become clean on the inside. It's the way we gain treasure in heaven. There's even a lovely verse in the Psalms. They have freely scattered their gifts to the poor. Their righteousness endures forever. That's a nice promise, isn't it? To have righteousness enduring forever. So why give to the poor? I think partly because I am ultimately poor in the face of God. I have nothing. I have not even breath in my lungs, but that God gives it to me. And therefore, if God sees me behaving the same way towards someone who has so much less than I do, then in a sense, God gets to see himself in us. He gets to see an eagle who's actually finally learned how to fly, who isn't using his wings to gather his possessions to his breast in sort of somewhat defensive mode, but actually scatters them abroad, as God does to me. This is how we can grow closer to God. Not the only way, maybe, but certainly a very important way. Isn't that what Genesis 1 said? I made man in my image. That's not a historical footnote. That's a mandate. It said, I made you. Now be in my image. Look at my image. My wings are spread. What about yours? God challenges all of us. We'll skip that for time. And let me finish with just this last couple of thoughts. So I monitored my own ecclesia's activities. And what I mean by that is whenever we came together, I said, why are we coming together? We're coming together for one of these six reasons. And they're all good reasons. There's no bad choices there. And more than, you know, usually on any time we met together for more than one. So there's usually two or three of those happened each time. And I counted up over 10 years from 2001 to 2010. And that was the little pie chart I was able to put together. That was the balance of our activities in a couple of hundred of meetings per year for 10 years. So a couple of thousand meetings go into the data pool there. And helping the poor is this purple color. Can you see purple? It's kind of wedged in there. The actual score was zero. There was never a time we took collections, and some of those monies went to the poor, but there was never a time when we could say, yes, we've come here to meet here together today in order to specifically help the poor. Not once in 10 years. So for the 11th year, that's supposed to be strikingly different. So you're allowed to go, ooh, at any point that it grabs you. And it's not exactly the biggest pie slice you've ever seen in your life, but at least, you know, it's off the mark, and it's started. And so it's quite a big step, even though it's a small step. And we've started having some activities when we come together for the purpose of helping the poor. What would be the ideal case? That's just my suggestion. I don't know. But they all seem to be very, very good reasons to come together. And maybe we should do them more in sort of more equal benefit. So that's a suggestion. So that's what we should do. We then become more like God. He is the shepherd to the stars, the chef to the lions and ravens, the midwife to the mountain goats. That's my own paraphrase of what he tells Job in Job 38. It changes who we are. When we start behaving in a more godly manner, we become more like God, and our own thoughts and feelings and empathies begin to grow and change. How to give to the poor? There's lots of simple things you can do. This is one thing I do at the moment. So I make up these little bags. There's water, there's food, there's sun cream in California. You can skip that one. There's toothbrush and toothpaste, there's aspirin. There's a few little things. There's no needles or razors which might get abused. There's no alcohol, mouthwash or anything that could be abused. But there's just a simple thing, and I keep that in the door pocket of my car. And I make them up at about 20 a time, and I give them out. You know, when you drive around in California, it's probably true here too. You know, the people stand at the side of the road, and they have a little cardboard sign saying that they are in need. Their story might be true, their story might be false. It's not my place to judge. It's my place to help. So I just hand it out the window and tell them God bless them and move on. And it's a very simple thing to do. Doesn't take a lot of effort, doesn't take a lot of money, but you can put it together. And I really enjoy the fact that I make these bags up about 20 at a time, and I store them at my workplace. I'm not going to clutch up my house with all the junk, so I store them on the shelves in work. And the nice thing is that my co-workers are very happy to take them to do the same thing and put them in the door pocket of their car. So they're more than happy to grab them. They haven't gone so far as to step over the hurdle and actually make their own. I'm more than happy with that. And so there's quite often that one particular co-worker is more energetic than me. If he sees a homeless person on the other side of the street, he will make a U-turn and go and chase them down. I'm too lazy to do that. If I meet them just right by the window, that's fine. But, you know, he's on a mission, and that's a good thing. And so it's really given us something to talk about and something to enjoy and share some very touching stories and very silly stories. It's a great thing to do together. I really should stop because we've gone over time. Last picture, that is actually, those are books. I took that photo a month ago. Those are books given to children in Haiti to read in French and Creole. All the money to buy those books was raised from the sale of calendars. The calendars were just made by one person. There's one of the girls enjoying the books. They were a big hit for a school, a Christadelphian-run school that we have in Haiti. And all of those, all paid for by the sale of calendars. The calendars made by one person, a female in Canada, and she's 11. Right? So pretty good. So at 11, you know, she's creative enough to have done that with some help from her parents, and that's what she was able to achieve just on our own. So I don't aim that high because I'm not as good as an 11-year-old Canadian girl, but, you know, I make up little bags and it's a good start.